Conestoga Podcast, episode 34 for September 6th, 2007. Pleased to bring you another podcast recorded at Conestoga 11. This time, my co-host is Conestoga's former programming chair and author, Melissa Tatum. Together, we interview Deborah LeBlanc, author and current president of the Horror Writers Association. Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. I am Chris Murley, the podcast host, and I want to welcome the Deborah LeBlanc, an author of psychological thrillers, to the podcast.
Thanks for the welcome, Chris.
Well, I realize this is your third year, and we really do appreciate you coming back, especially considering what happened the first year
wait,
you were here.
Wait, I get to tell this story.
Oh, you get to tell this story.
I get to tell this story.
Okay. I have a co-host who's going to help me interview Deborah, which is Melissa Tatum, my wife, and she was the programming chair the first year that Deborah joined us.
Yes, I remember we had been trying to grow our guest list at Conestoga for a while and had been trying to reach out to new authors and new to us, not necessarily brand new authors. But I was thrilled when Deborah came and was going to be here. I had seen some of her stuff and I was familiar with a little of her work, and it was just exactly who we wanted to start coming to Conestoga. And there actually was a couple of other things going on in town for me at work, and so I had to leave the convention and then come back to the convention. And I remember coming back and having an ambulance pull away from the front of the hotel and thinking, thank God that's not for us. And then the next morning, I'm putting things together in the green room, and Deborah comes in and tells me that was her taken away in the ambulance. I'm like, oh my God, she's never going to come back again. The first time here, she's taken away by ambulance because of food poisoning in the hotel. So we are very, very thrilled that you have come back now for 3 years in a row.
I've just stayed away from the chicken Alfredo. That's everything else is good.
Well, that was a fluke. The hotel does wonderful, wonderful food here, and we highly recommend it.
Yes, absolutely. Evidently, they still don't really know what it was, a seasoning or something, some quirky thing that just I was allergic to.
Right.
Okay.
So they were.
And then we not only did you survive the food poisoning, you came back and fulfilled all your con duties. I'm like, would you like the day off? Can we rearrange your schedule? And you were just, nope, we're ready to go.
That's it. I was alive. Hey, they were talking doing a trach. I was glad. I was happy. We didn't have to do that. I'm ready to do whatever you need.
Well, you are also at the moment president of the Horror. I don't know. Let's see if I get the title right. Horror Writers of America. Is that correct?
Horror Writers Association.
Association. Mm-hmm. Okay. I always sort of psych myself out about what the A stands for. So how long have you been president?
Since October.
And how long is your term?
2 years.
2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So were you drafted, or did you decide that you wanted to run for president?
No, I didn't. I wasn't going to stick my hand in that fire and say, I'll run. No, I actually had a good friend in HWA who said, you should run. I want to nominate you. If I do, will you consider it? And I really thought hard about it because, you know, for a lot of years, I considered it, it was a helpful association, but it was all mostly men. You know, women had a really tough time, and heaven help us put one at the helm, and I didn't know if it was going to implode.
Right.
You know, I didn't know what was going to happen. So, but I think it was just that challenge that had me say, oh, hell yeah, I'll do it.
Well, tell us a little bit about HWA. I'm familiar with the Science Fiction Writers of America, but not really with HWA. So how many members are there? What does the organization do? Just tell us a little bit about it.
The HWA is made up, was actually started in about 1985. Dean Koontz was one of its founders. And ever since then, it's been trying to, it's grown, been culled. You know, members, certain members, we're not so much a fan organization as we are specifically for writers and those published and those who've gotten minimal sales and are looking for major publication. It's kind of a learning ground for them. So we've fluctuated in membership numbers over the years. Right now we're pretty close to 500, but we're worldwide. We have some members in the UK and Australia, though the majority of our membership is here in the U.S., what the association is about is networking opportunities for its members. It's educational opportunities for its members, and most importantly, which is something HWA wasn't able to take advantage of before, simply because the way it was structured, was promotional opportunities for its published authors. We want to be able to get our authors out there in front of the libraries and in front of schools and really help build the readership, help the public understand what horror really is, that it's not just about, you know, Friday the 13th and somebody's running around with a dagger and slashing everybody up, that a lot of the horror that's out there is, you know, psychological horror. And it's just educating the public and then helping our writers gain a reader base.
As a reader, and as someone who worked in a bookstore for 10 years in high school and college, although that was a while ago, I have to say there really does seem to be more of a cyclical nature to horror than to some of the other genres. But it also seems to me, my impression is it's establishing more of a foothold, because when I was shelving at the various bookstores in high school and college, I don't remember there being a horror section in the bookstores. I was sticking them in the science fiction section or in the mystery section or in the regular fiction section, and it was harder for readers to find what they wanted. And, you know, they knew Dean Koontz, but they didn't necessarily know anybody else. Is that your impression as well? Is that your experience, that it seems to be establishing more of a foothold as a separate genre, or is it just becoming more, people are more aware of it?
I think more people are coming to accept the fact that it's different. The horror that's coming out now is very different than what came out in the 80s, in the mid-80s and late 80s. And so you're just as likely to get a romance reader to pick up one of the books, or a thriller reader, or a science fiction reader to pick up a horror novel, because it has the same elements. A lot of them now have the same elements of the other genres that they read. I personally like the fact that they don't shelve those particular books in a horror section. There is one bookstore that still has a horror section, and it's basically two shelves at the back of the store facing the wall like a punished child near the garden books, okay? You really have to be looking for horror to find it. I like the fact that it's in fiction. And, you know, you just go down Koontz, and if someone's looking for Koontz, I'm not that far away.
Right.
or Richard Layman, uh-huh. You know, right. It's usually right next to mine, so...
Well, tell us what makes your books horror, because as we heard at the top of the broadcast, Chris referred to you as a writer of psychological thrillers. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your work.
I consider my work psychological thrillers, because to true horror readers, they don't consider my stuff hardcore enough. You know, you may have a little blood and stuff going on because somebody's going to die, but you have that in mysteries. It's just not the... I don't do the whole monster thing. Most of it has to do with some psychological issue. The spirit world. A lot of the supernatural. That's what fascinates me, so that's what I try to write about.
Well, I just noticed, when I was doing a little research, your latest book just came out July 3rd, Morbid Curiosity, and it's going to be part of a release party we're going to have here tomorrow evening. What can you tell us about your latest book?
Morbid Curiosity was really interesting to write. It's about a set of twin girls who get caught up in chaos magic. And it's a matter of what you don't know can hurt you. You know, they realize what they've got their hands on, and their lives nearly get destroyed because of it. I actually found out about chaos magic and sigils through doing research on shamanism, and it started coming up, and I was so fascinated by the extreme nature of the practice that's when I decided to write the story about it.
Go ahead.
Speaking of the doing research, that sort of sparked a question I had when I was doing some research for this interview. Either radio interviews or print interviews had talked to you about the time you had yourself locked into a casket. But what for you was the most interesting research you've done in preparing for in any of your novels? What did you find sort of most fascinating or most interesting, or does it just vary depending on what you're working on a given project?
It varies. You know, I always have a thirst for knowledge, for new things. And reading about it is one thing, or, you know, when you Google it and find something on the internet is one thing. But putting it in your hand and touching it, feeling it, smelling it, that's very different for me. And that's what I try to get in my research as close as I can. That's why the whole I had myself locked in a casket for grave intent. You know, I visited tons of mental institutions, some abandoned insane asylums for family inheritance, and a house divided. I needed to get the most dramatic I got with the house divided, I think, was just taking a nail gun to a watermelon so that I could feel the pull of one that operates by a CO2 and get that shpuck, shpuck sound in my head so I could write it and feel that gun, because one of the psychos uses it to murder people.
And when you were writing Morbid Curiosity, tell us a little bit about chaos magic, because that's a new term for me, and I'm sure it might be a new term for a lot of listeners out there.
Chaos magic is like an extreme sport in black magic. There are a lot of teenagers specifically that practice it, and it's a basic belief that it uses sigils for the practice. And I'm going to use Mel as an experiment. Mel wants a new stereo, so she would write on a piece of paper, "I will have a new stereo." Okay, she writes this on a piece of paper. That sentence, you'll mark out every letter that's duplicated. So, for example, you have "I will have a new stereo." You're going to have to scratch out all of the I's except for one, all of the L's except for one. Now, what you have left is going to be a jumble of letters.
Okay.
The practitioner is going to either create a drawing from what the remaining letters will create an image, a subconscious image, to this individual person. They'll draw a picture about it, or they will create a word from it. For the stereo, you have to charge that sigil. That is going to be your sigil. That drawing or the word that you create is your sigil. That is the thing that's going to go get the stereo for you. Okay? That's the catalyst that's going to go get the stereo for you. But you have to charge it. To do that, they are either talking about something extreme sexually, like they'll do orgies, or they'll do bungee jumping with a cord that's frayed. They'll, depending on how big the intention or your wish is the bigger the charge you have to give this sigil. They even talk about the fact that many of them sacrifice family pets. There are a lot of people that were not aware of chaos magic. I know a lot of parents that weren't. There are a lot of people who think, you know, cutters. Mm-hmm. A lot of teens cut to feel. What they don't realize is that a lot of teens cut to feed these sigils, and they just don't know what's going on.
Wow,
that's frightening.
It is.
The description of it is frightening. Before you even think about charging the sigil, just the premise of how it works started playing with my mind.
Yeah, it does.
The horror film that has always sat with me my entire life is, and I may get the title wrong, I think it's called When a Stranger Calls, the one where the babysitter's in the house and
yes.
she's getting the calls, and they're like, "Get out, it's coming from inside the house."
Oh my gosh, yes.
I mean, Carrie, you know, all those, the slasher films did nothing for me, but that played with my mind in a way that I could never get that out of my head. And it really, my skin sort of started tingling when you were describing chaos magic, and I could just feel that reading about it and watching, you know, sort of being sucked into a world where that happened could have that same effect, where it just has a permanent, indelible mark.
Mm-hmm. That, to me, that is true horror, is in when it evokes the emotion, fear, of fear. You know, the slasher films for me just is disgust, or I either get just disgusted because there's so much gratuitous blood everywhere, or you just go, When are they going to quit going in that stupid cabin? How many times have they been out to that summer camp?
Yeah, don't go down and don't go in the basement.
Don't go in the basement.
Don't leave the group.
That's right. And don't leave the group in your underwear to go to that cabin at midnight, you know.
Right.
I mean, please.
Yeah, I'm kind of like old school stuff. I like to harken back to Lovecraft for my horror. But anyway, it's certainly fascinating to see what's going new that's going on in the field. Now, one of the things when I was doing research, I looked at your FAQ, your frequently asked questions, and I thought it was very well done. So I think a lot of those questions have already been asked and answered. The one I wanted to ask you about, first of all, is I can't pronounce the word. It's the healer, the traitor. How do you pronounce that word?
Traiteur.
And what I didn't see in the FAQ what novel that was for that you were, or I maybe I missed it.
A Family Inheritance. But in actuality, I didn't do research on traiteurs for Family Inheritance. I used the fact that I am a traiteur and my grandmothers were traiteurs to tell the story.
Well, for the listeners out there that haven't checked out the FAQ, tell us a little bit about a traiteur.
A traitor is basically someone that it's similar to laying on of hands, if you've ever heard that term. Mm-hmm. You know, where a healer, it's a Cajun healer or a treater that basically will take their hands and move them over some troubled spot or pained or diseased spot on your body. And there's a certain prayer that they say to ask God to basically remove it. You know, the pain, the bleeding, the whatever the issue may be. Mm-hmm. And it's something that's been handed down ever since we came to Louisiana, or were forced here, back in the 1700s.
I have a couple of relatives. Well, half my dad's family lives in Lake Charles.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I went to Lake Charles several times as a child. And then I worked at a summer camp in Louisiana for about 5 or 6 summers in a row. And it just struck me, some places in the United States have such a wealth of culture that they strike me as very fertile ground for the author. And Louisiana has always struck me as one of those. And it sounds like you find it that way, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, my grandmother, I was raised at the foot of a rocker, and she would tell me stories that, and to me, they were ghost stories. But my grandmother never lied. As far as I knew, she never lied. So when she was telling me a ghost story, it was about Uncle Larry or Uncle Henry saw this, and this. And or she had seen this, and this. And it was always about the supernatural and what disappeared where. And so my fascination with the supernatural started there. And the old customs, you know, like if you suspect that there's a ghost in your house, you can't light more than 2 candles in the same room, because that's where you're going to draw the spirit, unless you plan to have a priest there to bless it and take it out. As if you take too many candles and put them in one room and light them, you'll concentrate that spirit there to that light.
And that's not something you want to do.
I never got, you know, evidently not. I guess evidently not. I've never tried it. Let me put it that way. When you have those grandmothers that just had this look about them, you know, you didn't test it. You didn't test it out.
Well, I can certainly understand that. I like shifting gears a lot because I like the organic flow to these conversations. One of the things we saw an article about marketing and how important it is for an author to market their works. I took a look at a couple of the trailers for some of your novels on your website, and I thought those were fascinating. How did those come about, and how effective do you think they are, the little trailers you got for your novels?
I think when the trailers first came out, they were very effective because they were new. Everybody wanted to take a look at them, and because we've become such a visual society, mm-hmm. It sparked enough interest to have someone go and pick up the book. Normally it was for a reader, though, because a reader will understand that if I'm getting this kind of tickled in my visual, my external visual, I know from reading already what's going to happen internally, visually. Do you see what I'm saying? Picking up people that were not readers, though, it was not as successful. I think where you really get the biggest bang is if you can take these book trailers and put them out in movie theaters. I know some friends of mine, like Heather Graham, has used them in movie theaters, and she says every time they run, she sees a big boost in sales. That is very expensive to do.
Have you thought about putting them on YouTube?
You know, I'm so computer illiterate that I'm lucky I can turn my gadget on. I have a little guy that handles my website and a couple of assistants that, heck, even have trouble keeping up with MySpace for me.
Wow.
Maybe YouTube, but I wouldn't have a clue as to what to do with it.
Let me ask you, as someone who's been involved in organizing conventions, and I have 3 short stories published, but I've just really started trying to concentrate more on my writing because I always knew better than to say, if only I had the time I could write, because I always knew that you had to make the time. But being an academic, I had to wait till I survived the publisher perish before I could make time because I like to eat on a regular basis. And I like a roof over my head. And writing is very difficult to do that. You balance a career, 2 careers. You have a day job and you write. And now you're president of the Horror Writers Association. So how do you balance all of that?
Well, I'm really fortunate in that the companies that I have, I've got a great team of people that basically run it. You know, I have good managers. I have a good group. So when I go to my office, other than just doing a general overview and looking at the reports and signing the checks, of course, that'll always get stuck with the bills. But they're doing the day-to-day, so I get to write while I'm at the office.
That's wonderful. And has HWA sort of infringed on your writing time? I know when I started as I became a more senior academic, I got more administrative responsibilities. And one day I looked around and went, I haven't written an article in a year. What have I been doing with myself? And then I realized it was administrative work. And it seems to me there would be a lot of administrative work in being president.
It was at the beginning to get started because there was a whole shift in the board, and we had to figure out who was going to be responsible for who and for what. And whenever you're operating or working with a volunteer-based group, that is really tough. It's not like you're paying someone a paycheck and you can expect X performance. If they decide to just throw their hands up and say, I'm out of here, because their lives got busy, you can't fault them. So you have to pick up that responsibility. And until we finally got everything dealt out, you know, all of these little responsibilities dealt out, it was tough at first. I was answering, oh gosh, we were going back and forth with at least 50 to 100 emails a day.
Oh, my gosh. I get 50 to 100 emails a day, but most of them I can delete because, you know, they're not relevant to me. But when I have 25 or 30 that have to be answered, that's very, very time-consuming. Mm-hmm. And you've still found time to come to conventions. So let me ask you, from an author's perspective, what do you, as an author, value about conventions? What about it is something that attracts you to keep coming to conventions?
For conventions, like, one of the things I love about Conestoga is that there's a literary push to it. A lot of these types of conventions are really into gaming. I've attended a couple of them to help them move more toward a literary, to give it more a literary push. But some of them you just know that it's going to be a gaming thing. A gaming fan thing. So, and that's cool. Those I don't attend as often. Conestoga will be loyal to as long as they want me because, you know, your goal is to broaden a reader base for authors. And it's just vital that we produce more readers, period, no matter the genre, because so few people are reading today.
That's the thing that has startled me is I've always been an avid reader, and so many people are not reading today, but yet we're also seeing trailers for books in the theater, mm-hmm. and it just seems sort of an interesting mix of media to me. But at the same time, I came to the Harry Potter series late since the new Harry Potter book is being released in just a few hours now.
I know.
From when we're recording
dun, 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 dun.
I know. I came to the Harry Potter series late, just before Goblet of Fire, which I think was book 4,
yes.
came out. And in fact, book 4 came out while I was with my mom and my sister on a mother-daughter weekend in New Orleans.
Ah.
And we were in line for some little diner. It was a flower. Oh, I'm drawing a blank. Carnelian, Gardenia, some famous place where it's one of the standard places that my sister had found in the tour book to go. But there's maybe 30, 35 seats. So you wait in line. They push you towards your seat when it's your time. And so just ahead of us was clearly a dad and maybe a 10-year-old boy who was buried in the Harry Potter book Goblet of Fire. So I'm thinking, in fact, when their turn got called, his father took the boy by the shoulders and steered him to the counter for their turn at the counter. The boy wouldn't even put the book down. And I thought, even if I hadn't gotten hooked on the Harry Potter books independently as a reader, here is something that got a 10-year-old boy to carry around a 700-page hardback and not put it down. And I really hope now that the series is ending that that readership that it's built will keep going and start turning to other authors and trying new things, because I really think if we lose that reader base, not only is it difficult for writers to find an audience, but there's just something intrinsically valuable about a population that reads.
Absolutely. The thought of a whole generation being illiterate, basically illiterate, where we're spelling you with just a U, because that's what we've trained ourselves to do in email or in instant messages, is horrifying to me. That's horror. Yeah, these will be people leading our country one day.
And it just seems to me that reading brings the reader into a more active involvement with the book and triggers the imagination in ways that watching something on the screen doesn't trigger your imagination, because someone else has thought it through for you, not just given you clues for you to build it
yourself.
You're absolutely
right. That is exactly right. The imagination is like a muscle. And if you don't read, you don't exercise it. Your creative juices just kind of dry up, and you just let everybody else take care of it for you, in television or video or what. You're absolutely right.
And then the problem-solving skills are gone.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. That's right. I think that's why we see so much anger and aimlessness, with a lot of the teens today, because they don't have anything to glue themselves to. Everything's done for them. We've kind of created a microwave society.
Yes. I teach at the graduate school level. I teach in law school. And when I started teaching 12 years ago, I would ask my students, how many of you have had a job? Because part of my job is to get them to look at problems from different perspectives. And if they've been out in the work world, then they have different perspectives. And they've come at problems from different ways and met and worked with people who have different problem-solving skills. 12 years ago, about 80% of my students said they had had at least a part-time job. And now, 80% of my students have never had even a part-time job. And it's just amazing to me that here I have 22 to 24-year-old students who have never earned a paycheck, had to report to work on time, had to do what the boss said even when they didn't like the boss, had to figure out a way to solve a problem, to get the boss's attention, to get that, that extra time off or that promotion or that favorable treatment they wanted. And again, that ability to get along with other people, to do things and be proactive, is so important.
I agree.
This kind of dovetails. We got a question from the audience here, and they wanted us to ask you about your literacy challenge.
Oh, the literacy challenge ties into the very thing that you were talking about, and trying to find a way to encourage that age group or any non-reader to read. And basically the challenge is I used visuals. I had an artist draw scenes from Morbid Curiosity, for example, for this year's challenge. And you go to the scene, move the mouse over it, and it drops down multiple choice questions.
Uh-huh.
And the highest score of the challenge wins $5,000 in cash. Second place is a new computer, and then third through tenth are gift certificates to bookstores.
How long have you been doing a literacy challenge?
This is the third year.
Third year.
I do a lot of high school presentations, mostly public high schools, because I'm targeting middle to lower income neighborhoods. And I'm really trying to zero in on these teens that aren't reading and are blaming their parents, society, and everybody else for their anger and for not doing anything in life. So my challenge isn't only for them to read, but to take charge of their life. And next year, because of all of the discussions we've been doing at these high schools, mm-hmm. we've got some corporate sponsors who will be buying books for these kids.
Wow.
So
they'll
wonderful.
Have them for free. Yeah,
that's great.
Are you doing this mostly in Louisiana, or are you?
Oh, it's nationwide.
Nationwide.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are you also doing this in Louisiana as well, the literacy challenge?
Yes.
I kind of want to go back to Louisiana, your home state, because there's such a rich history that you can draw upon. And And what I want to ask about, because you're in the Lafayette area, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And I was looking at the map to see where it was in relationship to New Orleans, and I was wondering how, you know, the I don't want to say diaspora, but how the Katrina has affected not just your community, but, you know, what you've been seeing as far as have you seen a change in the culture since Katrina, before and after, or is it starting to come back?
It did change it significantly. Lafayette is the heart of Cajun country, which is very different than New Orleans. New Orleans is predominantly Creole, which is a different culture, has different traditions than the Cajun people. Now, both are extremely hospitable. When someone's in need, they're always there to lend a hand. So right after Katrina, we wound up with 40,000 evacuees in our city. We couldn't keep the store shelves stocked. Our streets weren't prepared for that number, you know, that amount of traffic. It was total chaos. Now you had city folks in with small town folks. And we were trying to be accommodating, understanding their situation, but it just, crime immediately jumped up 35%. Everybody was locking their doors now and carrying guns. And it was a whole different world. As things started settling down meaning as everybody who wound up in Lafayette started saying, okay, I'm going to make this place my permanent home, or I'm going back to New Orleans, Lafayette's starting to get its feet back on the ground. But it's changed. There's a change that's happened that we're never going to be back the way we were before. There's an innocence about it that was taken, an innocence that's gone.
Well, that's sad to hear, but hopefully we'll hear more about that innocence in more of your works and stories coming out of Cajun country.
You bet.
We've got a few minutes left here. Melissa, did you have any further questions or?
Well, can you tell us or give us a preview of what's coming next after Morbid Curiosity?
Actually, the title of my next one is Water Witch, and it's about a dowser from West Texas that has the ability to not only douse for water, but for missing people, gold, oil, those types of things. And her sister is married to a man from Louisiana, calls her in to douse for two children who were either kidnapped or got lost in the swamp. They don't know which. So her sister is really the only one who knows that how diverse her dousing ability is. And she brings her in, as we would say, back home, en cachet, under the, you know, kind of, I'm bringing you in, I'm not telling anybody what you do, but I need your help to find these kids. Her sister comes in, and she finds a heck of a lot more than she bargained for.
There's actually a very interesting study going on at the University of Tulsa, where I teach. There, we do a lot of interdisciplinary research, and the archaeology department and the geology department are working together to try and scientifically document dousing.
Wow.
And trying to find bodies. And so, so what they're doing is taking material samples of different places and then bringing dowsers in and then trying to see if they can actually find something in the site. So they're really anxious to see if they can first document the accuracy of the dowsing and that it's more than random chance, but also see if they can find anything in the soil that might be triggering that ability that they can perhaps scientifically figure out the mechanisms by which dowsing works.
Wow.
So it'll be interesting to see. They just started the study last spring.
How long are they expecting the study to go?
I am not sure. I need to check on that and see. They were waiting for the grant approval to come through. But I think it was going to be about a 6 to 8 month study was the impression I had.
That I'll be real interested to see what the results are.
I'll see if I can see when they expect their report.
That'd be great.
And when can we expect Water Witch?
Water Witch will be out in July of 2008.
Oh, okay. So we have a little bit of wait then. Okay.
Yes, Morbid just did come out.
Yep.
Oh, actually, I've got an anthology, a novella coming out in August.
Okay. And what are those going to be entitled?
The novella is called White Hot. And the short story I also have in the anthology is called Bottom Feeder. And the anthology itself has Gary Brombeck in it, Tom Piccarelli, Hank Schweibel, and Christopher Golden. It's called Five Strokes to Midnight, and it'll be available in August. Now, that's a limited edition anthology.
Ah, okay. And what was the title of it again?
Five Strokes to Midnight.
Five Strokes to Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Deborah, I want to thank you for coming and allowing us to interview you today at the Conestoga Podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thank you for coming back to Conestoga.
Thank you for inviting me.
For those of you who didn't get a chance to meet Deborah at Conestoga 11, she will be a guest at FENCON 4, September 20th through the 22nd, 2007, in Dallas, Texas. We like the folks at FENCON. It is a very well-run convention. In fact, we like them so much, we have made their con chair, Tim Miller, our fan guest of honor for Conestoga 12, which is to be held July 25th through the 27th, 2008. To find out more about FENCON, go to FENCON.org. More information about Deborah LeBlanc, her works, and her other upcoming appearances, check out DeborahLeBlanc.com. It's a little early to be talking about Conestoga 12, but in addition to our fan guest of honor, Tim Miller, our guest of honor will be Diana Gabaldon, and our artist guest of honor will be Stephen Hickman. Our web address is www.sftulsa.org, so until the next Conestoga podcast, take care. Lemurs were harmed in the making of this podcast.